Welcome to episode 109 of the Ron and Brian podcast.
I'm going to start out by sending one to the man sitting behind the Resolute desk. With all respect, sir, show some consideration and care for your countrymen and your country. Put on a fucking mask.
And thank you all once again for joining us here on the Ron and Brian podcast. I'm Ron. Of course, on the other side of the screen, on the other side of the mic, the man, the plasma donor, the hero of the common man, Brian. Brian, how the hell are you, my friend?
I'm good. I'm very good. I feel like the country has, you know, we were in a very in a bad place last week. And I feel like we have turned a corner and we are making forward progress on so many different social fronts. And I feel confident it's going to be smooth sailing. I think we are going to get a V-shaped economic recovery. I think we've got COVID beat. I think we've already solved racism. I think that the police and communities have come to an agreement on what the responsibilities for our law enforcement is going to be in this. It's just rosy. It's a rosy forecast I have over here.
Well, I'm glad you're feeling so optimistic. I saw you looked a little confused. That was Bruce Springsteen in the beginning of the intro, telling Donald Trump to wear an effing mask. And you don't hear the boss cursing ever, from what I remember.
That's the boss?
That was the boss on E Street Radio. He was introducing some music and, said he basically gave a longer speech he gave about, you know, why 100,000 plus U.S. citizens had to die while Trump focuses more on his reelection campaign. But I just like that little snippet because it really encapsulates, I think, what is wrong, especially with the GOP during this pandemic. I mean, you saw it with Mike Pence. He was in, I want to say, Michigan the other day, crowded restaurant, no mask, the whole nine yards.
It is actually beyond the mask. The mask at one point was the biggest issue. It's beyond that. It is now that the president and his administration are living in denial. They are openly denying that there is a public health threat that is going on in this country. And they're carrying on as if we don't acknowledge it, it's not a problem.
Well,
and then anyone who pretends it's a problem or acts like it's a problem, we can then just badmouth them and saying there's something wrong with them.
I mean, didn't Trump say in that Wall Street Journal interview today or yesterday that he felt that people are just wearing masks to show their disapproval of him, to show their disrespect for him?
Yeah, it's fucking ludicrous. It's absolutely fucking ludicrous.
Ludicrous. Well, since it is back to normal in America and back to normal in the podcast world, let's start things off as we often do.
Drink of the week.
Kicking it old school this week.
Salud.
Drink of the week.
Sláinte.
Drink of the week. Drink of the week.
Figured I'd bring back the old theme for 1 week. Just to, you know, it just makes me feel happy.
I love that. I love that theme.
What did you bring to drink this week, my friend?
I brought something. It's an all natural beverage that is something that I think we've all had at least once in our life. I made it special. It's two parts hydrogen, one part oxygen.
Ooh, is it ice cold?
So crisp, so crisp. That is actually water. We'll talk a little bit later why I'm drinking as much water. But in front of me right here, as you can see, is a local New York City beer. One of the things that I have decided to do as a result of the pandemic is support local businesses, support my local economy. So I reached out to the people at McKellar New York City Brewing, and they have a incredible German Pilsner, which is actually brewed with New York City water. I would describe it as a, I'd say it's a thoroughly local craft beer, clean and crisp, with a distinct New York attitude.
Nice. Mm. Well, McKellar is a legend in brewing circles, so I have to imagine that's pretty good right there.
That is one fucking crisp pill. I will admit, and I know it is passé, it is frowned upon, people turn their nose on Pilsners now. I love a Pilsner.
All right. Well, as we as I mentioned last week, we were going to get back into it with my official beer of the summer. This is a new release from our good friends at Broken Goblet. Lager King, their take on the whole Tiger King craze, I guess you could say. A blonde lager checking in at, 4.9%? I've already drank like half a case of these in the past week, but hold on. So good.
Did you say you drank a half a case?
This is the last can of my half a case. I still have your half a case protected in the fridge. So hopefully I don't drink that prior to seeing you again.
Who is protecting the stable from the fox?
I mean, it's really, you're really just counting on my self-control at the moment. Oof, I will say I did just get a bunch of beers from Levante Brewing in Westchester, so I'll probably be focusing on those. And I do have some crowlers from Broken Goblet to work through, so you may be in luck.
Can you tell me exactly why the Lager King is your beer of the summer?
So it's not too heavy. It's not too hoppy. It's very smooth. It's one of those beers that it reminds me of a Yingling, but with more flavor. Maybe a smoother taste. It's really one of those beers that you can just sit outside on a hot summer day, put down, you know, 2, 3, 12 of them, and it's going to be a good time.
I love it.
All right. And hopefully I'll be able to break through the coronavirus ring around New York City and bring you some of these beers soon.
We just got the go-ahead from Governor Mario Cuomo that New York City may now enter phase 2 in our reopening of the economy. That means we will be allowed this coming Monday outdoor dining. Mm. We will be allowed barbershops and hair salons.
Okay.
We will be offices are now allowed to reopen. And there's something else, and I don't remember what it is, which means it can't be as important as the other three.
True.
I am very interested to seeing how the rollout of outdoor dining is, along with how much the demand in New York City will be for outdoor dining. Because one of the things about New York is that it is almost considered passé for you to eat dinner at home. It is just, you know, Manhattan is a dining out town. One of the things I like about it is the fact that there are just so many restaurants. You know, which restaurants have survived? Which ones have closed? Are we going to have a situation where you have to make an appointment, a reservation weeks in advance to be able to sit outside? Have people fled New York City and the demand's not going to be there? We'll find out this coming week.
All right. We also received word down here in Philadelphia that Philadelphia apparently will get to move to the green zone on July 3rd. Coincidentally, just in time to capture those tourism dollars over the 4th of July weekend.
What is, so you've got red, yellow, green.
Correct.
What are you still prohibited from doing once you've entered green?
So with green, you still have limitations as to, like, you can do indoor dining, but at 50% capacity.
Okay.
You know, you are still limited in the size of the gatherings you could attend. Like, I think the gathering size goes up to like 250, but you still, like, we still couldn't have like a baseball game or a football game or a concert or anything like that. You still have to, you know, the masks are still recommended. It's still recommended to follow the CDC guidelines. So again, we will see how Philadelphia responds, how the people around Philadelphia respond, if they're going to come back to the city for that. It'll be interesting to see.
It's weird you put it that way, because it sounds like there's different activities that have different risk levels.
It would appear that way. And I
wonder if there was some, if there was some recent study performed where they ranked different outdoors activities that in terms of how dangerous they were.
I mean, perhaps there is.
Yes.
Oh.
Four public health experts in Michigan, Dr. Matthew Sims, Dr. Dennis Cunningham, not Richie, Dr. Mimi Emig, and Dr. Nasir Hussein, who was not involved in 9/11, got together and they put out a report on 36 different activities and attributed a ranking on a scale of 1 to 10.
1 to 10.
Being the safest.
Okay.
10 being the most dangerous.
All right.
And I was wondering if you would be willing to take a short quiz.
I'll give it a shot.
Okay. Now, I'm going to give you the activity. I want you to tell me on a scale of 1 to 10 what you think the risk level is. And cut me off when you think this bit has died.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay, we're going to start off with something simple. Bars.
Bars? I believe bars was actually up there. I believe bars was like a 6.
Bars are a 9.
All right.
And the major reason for that is that alcohol affects people's judgment decision-making.
Don't you know?
And will cause people to do things that they would not normally have done. There was a story this past week coming out of Florida, I believe it was. Was it Florida where a group of friends, there was 15 of them, went out for a night of drinks? And they said that they had socially distanced prior to, but they went out drinking. Now all 15 have tested positive for the coronavirus.
And I believe 9 people at the bar itself have tested positive.
Well, then going to bars is fucking risky at a 9. What do you think about large music concerts?
Oh, large music concerts, I got to give that an 8.
Ooh, not dangerous enough, Ron. That number's coming in at a 9. The reason for that is that you've got large groups of people packed into us to a, you know, albeit it may be an arena or a stadium, but there is a hot, is just an incredible amount of density, as well as the likelihood of alcohol and other substances being ingested.
All right. What else you got?
This one was a little surprising to me. Gyms.
Gyms. I'm going to put at a 6.
Going to bump it up to an 8. And the reason for that is that people emit more respiratory secretions when working out, as they are usually breathing heavily.
Well, that sounds the
same. Also, it's going to be, they predict it will be difficult to do cardio while wearing a mask.
That would be tough. I would agree. All right. Why don't we do one more?
One more. I got 32 of these.
2 more. I'll give you 2 more. Make them good.
What about casinos?
Casinos, all right, you've been going high. There's a lot of people at casinos. It's a lot of compressed air. I'm going with an 8 on casinos.
Down. They're only giving it a 6. There is a lot more built-in social distancing to a casino layout, as there are pre-prescribed seating arrangements. People don't tend to pack in as closely at a casino as they would at a sporting event.
I would disagree with you. Have you seen a craps table? People are literally on top of each other. But again, I'm not an expert. So, I mean, I guess maybe the potential of social distancing is still there.
Airplanes.
Airplanes are an 8.
5.
Wow. How is an airplane a 5?
And this one is one where I threw it in there, because there are varying opinions on the safety of an airplane. 2 of the 4 experts listed it as a medium risk, 1 at a low, and the other is says it's a high risk. A lot of the logic is the fact that the air is circulated through the plane from external air, so that you're actually getting fresher air in an airplane today than you are in other modes of transportation.
All right. I guess, again, I will defer to the experts.
There you go. And what is, if you had to pick, what was ranked the lowest?
What was ranked the lowest? I assume yes. Staying at home.
Outdoor activities.
Oh, outdoor activities?
Two activities came in at number one. Two activities with a risk level of one.
A risk level of one. I have no idea.
Getting takeout from a restaurant.
Okay.
Playing tennis.
You are socially distanced. Stay away from that ball boy, though. He is rife oddly, with COVID.
Oddly left off of this list was a gangbang in a Thai whorehouse.
I would say that would probably be high. That would be a 9, personally. Maybe even a 10. But
all depends. I've not heard what the coronavirus numbers are coming in from overseas, but we certainly are seeing case numbers increase in states that have not previously recorded the number of cases that they're having now.
Well, maybe we'll share a link to that article so people can see what the risks of all these activities are and then make their own decisions how they want to proceed forward.
That would be great.
In the meantime, let's visit This Week in Racism.
This week
in Racism.
So we had the discussion last week as to whether to continue doing this or not. We did get some feedback from some listeners that we appreciated. We talked about it ourselves. And I think what we decided was that we're going to continue doing This Week in Racism because we do feel that it's important to keep pointing out racists that are going on out there. But I think we'll probably not do the weekly voting, the weekly contest. But that is not to say that you may not see racism madness rear its head at the end of the year so we can really remember all of these shitty people that we encountered throughout the year. Was that what we agreed on, Brian? Is that somewhat?
Absolutely. I think what we agreed upon, and when I say we agreed, you informed me that this was going to be our policy as you are the 51% shareholder. What you said to me was that we were going to strip out some of the lighthearted takes that we had on some of the racists in fear that somehow it would be misinterpreted by people out there as condoning terrible behavior. Our attempts had always been to shed light on awful people, and we wanted to make sure that our voices were heard in the manner that we wanted it to be, that these are truly awful and despicable people.
Very well put. And as we unfortunately suspected, as the country starts to open back up, racism cases jumped as well as coronavirus cases. So what did we see this past week? Down in Knoxville, Tennessee, an employee at Knox Ridge Apartments has been placed on disciplinary leave after she was recorded on video blocking a group of black residents from entering the complex's swimming pool area. Cheryl Eastman was caught on video telling the resident that, quote, "I know everyone who lives here," and, quote, "Bitch, you haven't even come in and done your paperwork, right?" This comes 1 week after an incoming student at University of Tennessee Knoxville was seen on a video on social media using a racial slur. Two of the stars of the reality show Vanderpump Rules were fired by Bravo TV for the racist way they treated the only black co-star on the show. In 2018, Stassi Schroeder and Kristen Doubt tried to get castmate Faith Stowers arrested by falsely implicating her in a crime. Bravo no. also fired newer cast members Max Boyens and Brett Caprioni after oldest racist tweets of theirs surfaced. This was a big story in the last week. CrossFit's CEO and founder Greg Glassman retired after backlash from a tweet he made stating that racism was a public health issue, referring to it as Floyd 19. It was later learned that on a Zoom call the same day he made that tweet, he told gym owners, quote, "We're not mourning for George Floyd. I don't think me or any of my staff are." He went on to say, quote, "Can you tell me why I should mourn for him? Other than it's the white thing to do. Other than that, give me a reason." He also recounted unfounded conspiracy theories on the call that included speculation that Floyd was killed to silence him due to a purported baseless role in a criminal conspiracy involving counterfeit money. That's I don't know if that's racism or craziness or both, but there's a lot going on in that guy's head.
Yeah, I would say so.
Speaking of craziness, that's Shorewood, Wisconsin. Attorney Stephanie Rapkin was arrested for allegedly spitting on a black protester at a Black Lives Matter rally, and then again when she was seen in a video shoving a college student that was writing protest messages in front of her house. As she was being arrested for the incident, she allegedly kicked a cop in the groin. While she faces charges of battery and disorderly conduct, community leaders have asked for her to be disbarred and charged with a hate crime. She's got some anger issues there.
Well, apparently so.
St. John's University fired an assistant fencing coach after video of a Zoom call he had with a youth group was posted on Instagram. Boris Vaxman was seen saying, quote, "The most trouble coming from where? From black people, because they don't want to work. They steal, they kill, they drugs. Everything comes from them. I think, what's his name? Lincoln made a mistake." SJU was quick to disavow Vaxman's statements and removed his profile from their fencing website. I mean, it really just went on and on this week. There was a viral video in Palm Beach County, Florida, showing a white man threatening three kids, including a black teenager, with arrest because they didn't, quote, belong in his gated community. Out in Torrance, California, there was a woman, Lena Hernandez, who popped up in a number of racist videos and was identified by the Torrance Police Department as the individual accused of assault and hateful speech against two people at Wilson Park on June 10th and allegedly pushing and striking a person at the Del Amo Mall back in October. Police, being lazy, decided not to press charges because the incidents are considered misdemeanors and officers did not personally witness the crimes. Just kind of wiping their hands of that, I guess. And then I think our worst person of the week, and again, just personal opinion, came from Pacific Heights, California. That is Lisa Alexander, CEO of La Face Skincare, called the police on James Juanilo for stenciling a Black Lives Matter sign in chalk on the front of his own home. James is a gay Filipino man who felt that they targeted him because of his race. The audio is a little hard to hear, but I believe you can hear Lisa's condensation fairly clearly the whole way.
Is this your property? Hi, I'm asking you if this is your property.
Why are you asking?
Because it's private property.
Because it's private property,
so
sir.
So are you defacing private property or is this your building? You're free to express your opinion.
No,
not on people's property.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Just respectfully.
Sure.
So we're just saying, absolutely, your signs and everything, and that's good. This is not the way to do it.
Okay.
It's private property.
But if I did live here and it was my property, this would be absolutely fine.
Totally.
If I live here or if this is my property.
We actually do know. That's why we're asking.
Oh, really? Because you live here, right? You said so.
Because we know the person who does live here.
Oh, okay. I suggest you call him or call
you.
The police.
Call the police.
Because you're accusing me of a crime, correct?
What I'm asking you is, why are you...
And I'm not answering you.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair.
So your choices are to call the cops if you believe I'm calling a crime, and I will more than be happy to talk to them.
Okay, thank you.
What's your name again?
I'm Lisa.
Lisa, what's your last name?
What is your name?
What's your name?
Well,
I asked first, Lisa.
Crime,
what's your name, sir?
Robert.
What's your last name, sir?
What is your first name, sir?
I'm not answering. I'm not talking to you. You're talking to me. I'm asking you the questions.
Well, we're not doing anything illegal.
Neither am I.
Actually, you are. Actually.
Really? Oh, okay. Well, then call the cops.
We will do
so. Lisa and Robert.
Yeah.
I'll be right here.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Bye. And that, people, is why Black Lives Matter.
And Lisa did end up calling the cops, who just drove up and didn't even bother getting out of the car, apparently, because they know James. They know he owns the house. It was just basically a waste of their time. But since this video went viral, Birchbox, a makeup distribution service, posted on its Instagram that it was cutting ties with La Face. La Face took down its social media and its company website. In addition to that, Alexander's partner, Robert Larkins, who you hear in the background there, was fired from his job at wealth management firm Raymond James.
What is La Face in this story?
She is the CEO of this company. I guess it's a cosmetic skincare type company.
Got it. So the woman is the head of some company.
Correct.
Got it.
But just
fuck the both of them.
Just the condensation. Just
it's oh, so terrible. Listen,
your message is fantastic, but this is not the way to do it. And we know who owns this house. Telling the guy who owns the house, we know who owns this house. You clearly own this house.
Yeah.
Fuckers.
It's the sense of privilege that exists in this country right now. It's the inability for people to admit that they may be wrong, that they may not be as informed as they think they are. And it is I think this is something that has really come to light over the past, say, 6 months or so. It's the racism that is wrapped up and blanketed in the, I'm just trying to do good for my community.
Yeah. You're writing on a wall in chalk, sir. That's just horrible.
You don't live in this apartment complex because I've never processed your paperwork.
Right. Well, I know everyone.
Do you work all the time? Like, is it possible somebody has moved in recently? Like, it is the latent racism that is, I think, and it's one of the things that we've learned. Simply because you're not shouting the N-word does not mean that you're not exhibiting racism.
Correct. It's the people that aren't shouting it that try to keep it hidden that are probably doing the most damage.
Yeah, I'm sure. So, absolutely.
If you've got any submissions for This Week in Racism, go to ronandbrianpodcast.com. We've got links to all of our social media there, as well as our contact us form. So we always love to get listener submissions. If you take any of your own video or you just want to share a link, please connect us with that. In the meantime, let's bring back Beef of the Week.
Ron and Brian's Beef of the Week.
Brian, what's bothering you this week?
Residents of New York City that refuse to wear a mask outdoors. Hmm. I don't even know that I need to expound upon that whatsoever. New York went through the worst American experience of corona to date. And I don't mean the beer. I'm talking about the virus. It is the fact that I believe the most recent number I saw was that 29,000 New Yorkers, and not just New York City, throughout the state, but we know that, you know, the Capital District area and the Finger Lakes area were not hit as bad. But 29,000 New Yorkers died from the coronavirus literally in the past 4 months. And that it appears that we have climbed the mountain and we have walked significantly down that mountain. We don't know if we're in a valley. We don't know if we have hit sea level and it's smooth sailing since. But it fucking irritates the shit out of me that people who live in New York, who witnessed and survived what this state and this city went through, are so fucking selfish that they feel it's acceptable to go on a subway and not wear a mask, that they feel it's acceptable to walk down a street without wearing a mask. Now, keep in mind, if you are walking in a quiet neighborhood and there's nobody around you, I think it's okay to take your mask off. But if you're on a fucking subway, where the balls do you get off the lack of courtesy towards the other New Yorkers that are on that subway car? It drove me nuts over the past week.
I don't blame you. I mean, what always kind of boggles my mind when you look at the sheer numbers is one in every four coronavirus deaths in the nation took place in New York City.
Yes.
One city out of however many cities in 50 states, one out of four was in New York City.
It's almost as if they have forgotten the refrigerated trucks that were parked outside of hospitals that were literally being stuffed with corpses because our morgues and funeral homes could not accommodate the dead.
I mean, it's basically, you know, the equivalent of 10 9/11s over the last 120 days. How many New Yorkers have died.
Never forget 9/11.
But people are forgetting the masks.
Forget COVID. Forget COVID. That never happened. Ron, what's bothering you?
You know, my beef is being unemployed still. You know, okay. I am. At first, I was like, "All right, I'll be unemployed. That's fine. I can relax a bit, recharge my batteries, get some things done around the house." But now it's beating me down, Brian. The constant work in the yard, the constant work around the house. I'll admit it. I'm not cut out for physical labor. That is not in my wheelhouse. My back aches every day. My legs ache every day. My arms ache every day, and I pray for death. It's okay. Kind of where I'm at.
Now, this may be a first, because I think that the issue here is not the fact that you're unemployed. It's the fact that you are spending your time while unemployed doing physical labor.
It's out of control. Absolutely out
of control. I think your issue is the physical labor that you're doing on a daily basis. I think that if you did not create all of these home repair, home improvement projects, and you spent the morning sipping your coffee, perusing news websites, and watched TV for an hour and a half, took a nap at around 11 or so, woke up at 12, made lunch for your wife and you, spent the afternoon maybe watching a movie, taking maybe a walk around the neighborhood, maybe
a nice
dinner.
10-minute power nap, you know.
Yeah. I think that you would be perfectly okay.
Well, let's be fair. I'm not the one coming up with all these home improvement projects.
But you are the one accepting them.
Well, I mean, what's my alternative?
Who wears the pants in that household, Ron?
Listen, it's not a matter of who wears the pants. It's who doesn't want to get a shiv in their side in the middle of the night.
She will stab you.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. She will cut me and not think twice about it. So either...
Now, is it true... Is it true that she just ordered a vat of sardine oil?
I hope not. If I see the tigers and the sardine oil come in, I know I'll be in trouble.
I don't want that to happen.
Thank you. But in the meantime, let's talk about you, my friend. As someone with the COVID-19 antibodies, you did something today very kind, very benevolent, and very giving. And I'd like you to tell us about it.
Okay. Today, I left my office at about 11:45. I got on the subway. I went up to the Grand Central area of Manhattan, and I sucked off a homeless man.
No, after that. After you did that.
Oh, when I gave those two twinks a handy?
Oh, boy. Talk about your plasma.
Oh, boy. All right. All joking aside, today, as I was able to partake in an act that quite possibly could save a life, not something I do on a regular basis. Today, Ron, I donated 800 milliliters of my own plasma taken out of my arm right here. If you can see.
I mean, for those listening to the podcast, I don't know that they can actually see.
It's fucking red. It's red and irritated. Anyway, as somebody who has been confirmed to have the coronavirus, antibodies flowing through my body with each pump of the heart, I saw that the New York Blood Center was asking people who had survived the coronavirus to come in and donate their plasma, which is the part of the blood that does contain the antibodies, to donate as they are studying the possibilities of being able to transfuse this plasma into human beings that currently have coronavirus, and future potentially people who don't have it are going to be given the antibodies through this plasma as a form of protection. And I sat there and saw that the New York Blood Center had asked for survivors to step forward. As you know, my family is full of survivors. If you go back through the family tree, I'm sure I can reach out to some family members that I have who are very keyed into the genealogical history of my family. And, They will be able to show me which relatives of mine are survivors, and I would like to add my name to that list.
I think you can.
Because I went in today. It's a very easy, very simple process. They literally plugged a couple wires up my arm. I sat in a chair for about an hour. I took a couple work calls. Nobody yelled at me. I took a bunch of selfies. Nobody yelled at me. I texted my friends. Nobody yelled at me. And then after the bag had been filled, they cut me off. They gave me a thing of apple juice. They gave me a packet of pretzels and some Lorna Doone cookies.
I was going to ask if you got the cookies.
So good. And I highly recommend anybody that has the ability, if you have any type of a special blood type, donate blood. If you have the coronavirus antibodies, donate your plasma. Just this past week was National Donate Blood Day. And I probably would have never even thought about it, but I am now on board donating blood. I don't mind that my DNA is going to be sloshing through some other person. If I can keep one person from having to go through what I did, I had a relatively mild case of it. I only lost 20 pounds in 3 weeks. I mean, it's not like they needed a pitchfork to pick up my carcass and put in and shove in a refrigerated truck.
Brian, have I told you lately that you're my hero? You are what I hope to be. I hope to be a survivor. I hope to be a plasma donator. And if you reach into your soul, Brian, you will know that Brian is the better person on this podcast. And then a hero. Oh, it's a little too early. Sorry. But yeah, I sincerely feel that you are a hero, that you are helping the fellow man, and God willing, that plasma donation will help someone down the line.
I hope it helped. I hope it helps somebody. It would be great. It really would be great if the medical community can figure out a way to extract the antibodies from my plasma and transfuse it into another human being's body, which will accept it and prevent this person from getting ill. I will say that without mathematical certainty, I do feel less afraid of getting coronavirus right now.
All right.
Because I've had it. I cannot say for certain that I absolutely cannot get it again. I cannot say that it will not mutate in some form or not, but I do feel less afraid outside. Maybe it is because New York State is right now has the highest percent of people testing positive for the coronavirus. Maybe that helps.
Yeah,
but you know what? I'm going to say this, and I like to joke on the podcast a lot. I've not led a life that I would normally consider generous towards other people. And I do feel that over the past 3 or 4 months, I have seen an opportunity to be a better person towards those around me. And I have, obviously this is probably the biggest step that I have taken during this time, but I absolutely feel that, everybody has the power to make the world a little bit of a better place. If it's, thanking the subway conductor for getting out of the house every day to make sure that you, to help you get to work. So you don't have to walk or drive or ride a bicycle or whatnot. If everybody did one thing to make to put a smile on someone else's face, this world would just be a much better place for us to be.
It's the little things and the big things you can do to be a better person.
Absolutely, today was a big thing.
Someone who does not seem to have the ability to be a better person would be our president, Donald Trump, raising a lot of eyebrows, angering a lot of people for his initial plans to hold a rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma tomorrow, the anniversary of Juneteenth. Just very, I don't know what the word I'm looking for is, short-sighted.
Now, this is the question that I have.
Okay.
And I don't mean to cut you off.
No, of course not.
I know that Juneteenth is an important day in the history of the African-American experience in this country.
Yes.
It is the day that commemorates Lincoln.
No.
See, and this is
you're not even in the ballpark.
Fuck me. Fuck me. I just got this grand thing. You know what, Ron? Is there a way that you could in some way educate me right now in a way that does not make me feel absolutely stupid? But what is the significance of what actually is Juneteenth, and what is the significance of what is so terrible about Trump going to Oklahoma?
All right. Well, Tulsa specifically. Well, and we will dust off a bit that we haven't done in a little while. It's time for our horrible history. It should be. I don't know why that didn't play. Let me try it again. Time for our horrible history.
Our horrible history.
Yes, we have quite the horrible history in this country. We haven't done a horrible history in a while, probably because everything in the present has been just ungodly horrible. So we're going to give you a twofer this time. We will touch on Juneteenth a bit. And Brian, what it actually commemorates, June 19th, is it commemorates the Union Army General Gordon Granger's reading of federal orders in the city of Galveston, Texas, on June 19th, 1865, proclaiming that all slaves were now free. Even though the Emancipation Proclamation had freed the slaves 2.5 years earlier, enforcement of the proclamation had been slow and inconsistent. So apparently in Texas was the slave state with the furthest distance from the Union states, relatively few Union soldiers there. So apparently there was never any real push by the government to make sure that the slaves were being freed. So in Texas, slavery still existed for 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. And it wasn't until this Union Army general rode into Galveston, read these orders, that the last slaves in the country were finally free.
Jesus Christ, I had no idea.
And that's the thing, like everyone talks about, you know, Lincoln being the great emancipator. And sure, he did, you know, write the Emancipation Proclamation. He did free the slaves in the South. He didn't free the slaves in the North. A big push to free the slaves in all of the South either.
But didn't Lincoln have a questionable relationship with the African American slaves at the time? Wasn't it a questionable relationship?
In what way?
No, isn't that what Trump said earlier this week in an interview?
You know, he was
being interviewed by an African American reporter from Fox News, and Trump tried to sit there and say that he was better for African Americans than any other president in the history
including Lincoln.
And the woman came back, which I mean, a gutsy call for someone who has abandoned their race and gender by accepting a job at Fox News. But she pushed back and said, well, Lincoln did free the slaves, at which point Trump said, yes, but, you know, he had a questionable relationship with the, with the blacks. And I was just like, what?
Well, again, maybe the assassination, you know, stopped his progress there. But there definitely did not seem to be a push after the Emancipation Proclamation to make sure that all slaves in the South were free. Is even more, to kind of get on a sidetrack a bit, what was even more infuriating about Trump is in that Wall Street Journal interview, he basically said, well, no one really understood what Juneteenth was. No one knew what it was until I started talking about it. Even though his own White House issued a proclamation every single year on Juneteenth for every year that he's been in the White House. But he literally said, well, I asked the people in my inner circle and none of them have ever heard about it. Well, yes, because you have an inner circle full of racists and white nationalists. So, of course, like they're not going to know about it.
Like Stephen Miller is going to raise his hand to be like, actually, sir, let me educate you on Juneteenth.
Yeah, it wasn't going to happen. No. So Juneteenth is one thing. But for the location selected to have been Tulsa, Oklahoma, took it to a new level because that was the location of the Tulsa Race Massacre back in 1921. So this took place on May 31st and June 1st when mobs of white residents attacked black residents and businesses of the Greenwood District in Tulsa, Oklahoma. The attack destroyed more than 35 square blocks of the district, which at the time was the wealthiest black community in the United States. It was known as Black Wall Street. It started on Memorial Day weekend when 19-year-old Dick Rowland, who was a black shoeshiner, was accused of assaulting Sarah Page, a 17-year-old white elevator operator. So apparently Sarah worked in a place called the Drexel Building. The only place that black people could go to the bathroom downtown was a bathroom on the top floor of the Drexel Building. So Dick and Sarah would have known each other. And after everything was said and done, you know, charges were never pressed. People felt that it wasn't it was probably some sort of misunderstanding. There probably was no assault involved. But in the meantime, he is obviously arrested. After he was taken into custody, a large group of whites surrounded the courthouse where he was being held, leading to rumors that he had been lynched. This led to a group of the black population going to the courthouse, some of whom were armed. Shots were fired, and in that initial altercation, 12 people were killed, 10 white people and 2 blacks. As news of the death spread, white rioters began to rampage through the black neighborhood, killing people and burning and looting stores and businesses. The Oklahoma National Guard eventually managed to get control of the area by declaring martial law. But at the end of the 2 days, about 10,000 black people were left homeless, and property damage amounted to more than $1.5 million in real estate and $750,000 in personal property, which would equate to about $33 million today. The property was never recovered, nor were they compensated for it. And, you know, as after the fact, as it was researched, you know, there were implications that the law enforcement didn't do their jobs in Tulsa, that they were deputizing white people and providing them with weapons to then, you know, kill the black people in Tulsa. They were flying in airplanes and dropping firebombs onto buildings. They were machine gunning blacks in the streets. And when the National Guard came in, who did they arrest? They arrested the black people.
White people. What?
they detained up to 6,000 black people for up to 8 days following the race massacre. And just the name had to be was changed after the fact to the Tulsa Race Massacre. It was initially called the Tulsa Race Riots because, from insurance purposes, if it was a riot, the insurance companies did not need to pay any claims as a result of it.
No. So,
and this was something that was swept under the rug in American history for years and years. Finally, in the 90s, there was a commission put together to, you know, research the massacre. And
the 1890s.
No. This was, again, not happened in 1921. Not until 1993 was a commission put together to look into what happened, to try and research as much as possible. There is still no tally as to the number of dead. The official number of dead is 36. The commission put the actual number somewhere between 150 and 300.
In
2 days. The bodies have not been recovered. They did try and searching for mass graves afterward, have not found it. So what this commission, after a number of years, I want to say 6 or 7 years, you know, came back with some suggestions. A lot of it tied to reparations, saying if there are people still alive that were impacted by this massacre, they deserve reparations. If there are families that had people that were killed in this massacre or lost property, they deserve reparations. At the end of the day, you know, what ended up happening is the governor of Oklahoma acknowledged the massacre. They put up a monument to the people that died, but no reparations were ever given to any family. And this was touched on. We played a audio clip last week of a woman who said, you know, we tried to build it up and you burned everything down. And Tulsa was specifically one of the areas that she mentioned. And it was an area that, because of the oil business, Native Americans and African Americans found substantial wealth for that time. And mm-hmm. there was a group of poor white people, a lot of them Klan members. I think statistics said about 3,200 people in Tulsa were members of the Ku Klux Klan at that time. And they saw, you know, they saw Native Americans, they saw African Americans with money, and they didn't like it. And they saw this as an opportunity to take everything they had. They took jewelry out of people's homes. Apparently, for years after this, black women would be walking down the street seeing white women wearing their family jewelry because it had been stolen from them. So, again, for a man who, I'm not going to say he's the most racist president because we've had a few. But he's definitely.
I would imagine we've had more.
But he's definitely a racist, and so to hold an event on Juneteenth is one thing. To hold it in the location of the worst race-based hate crime and massacre in American history takes it to an entire another level.
Can I ask you a question?
Of course.
Based where you have been following the Trump administration from day one. So I would like to consider you an educated person in terms of what I'm about to ask.
Okay.
Do you think that this was intentionally selected in terms of date and location? Or do you think that it was a location and date that were picked without any sense of let's check and make sure that this can't be that this won't offend someone?
I will say this. I do not believe that Donald Trump has any knowledge about what Juneteenth or the Tulsa race massacre was.
Well, nobody had heard about it until, you know, until he started talking about it.
But I have to feel whoever in his administration put these plans together, it is too much of a coincidence for these two things to converge in one event.
Okay.
I mean, just the fact that he is rushing back to do rallies while the pandemic is still going on. And then this is, you know, one of the areas that they rush to do this in. I don't know. I don't think Trump did it intentionally because I don't think he's got that level of knowledge. He's not smart enough to plan that. But could a Stephen Miller have done this? Easily. There is. Okay. It's not tough to picture that.
Okay. Yeah, I don't imagine that Donald Trump is opening up a map of America, putting his finger down and saying, "All right, here is where we're going to meet." And I don't think he's looking at his calendar and just winding his finger, boom, this is the day we're going with. I imagine somebody approaches him and says, "Hey, you know, this is what we're thinking. This is our recommendation. Are you okay? Do you want to make any changes?" I imagine that's what's going on. But like, I can't. It's just so sad to believe that this was intentionally done.
And again, there is always the slight possibility that it wasn't. But it's real hard to picture. I mean,
so slight
out of all the days of the year and out of all the cities in the country for those two things, like I said, for those two things to converge on that day in that city, Trump would have to be one of the unluckiest son of a bitches. He'd have to be the kind of guy that bankrupts a casino. Like that's how unlucky he'd need to be.
Or an airplane.
Or a steak company.
Or a university.
Or bottled water. I mean, shit. Bottled water is easy money.
We're saying he fucked up bottled water?
Trump water? You don't remember Trump water? Trump wine?
No. It almost feels like the only thing he did right was The Apprentice.
I mean, it did get good ratings.
The most wonderful ratings. The most wonderful ratings in all.
Schwarzenegger couldn't get ratings as big as mine.
They were huge, huge. It's really depressing.
Yes, very depressing.
I did not realize all those details.
It's what I'm here for, just to depress you.
Whether you like it, I don't understand how anyone cannot acknowledge that the African American community has had an awful experience in this country.
And that's just one example. You know, that's one example of many. Again, we saw it again this past week with a black man being killed in Atlanta, you know, because he was sleeping in a Wendy's parking lot, you know, Rayshard Brooks. And again, you could argue, oh, he resisted arrest. He tried to run. He pointed a taser at him, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, how does it escalate to that point, you know, when he's sleeping in a fucking fast food parking lot? And I think Trevor Noah kind of nailed it. It's like every single time there's an excuse. He shouldn't have been sleeping in a parking lot. He shouldn't have run. He shouldn't have been a kid in a park with a toy gun. He shouldn't have been sleeping in his own home. He shouldn't have been in his couch in his own home. The only thing that ties all these things together is the color of their skin.
But it also is, if you, you know, Trump, who really is just, you know, the bringer
of the unifier
of Americans. He's a unifier. He's a great unifier. His comment about the Atlanta shooting was, you cannot resist. You can't resist the police. That if you resist the police, you get anything that's coming towards you. And what is so frightening with that mindset is that it basically allows the law enforcement at that moment to be judge, jury, and executioner.
Yeah.
Is the fact that you're basically saying that if a person resists arrest, then therefore we are opening the book that the police officer or sheriff or highway patrol or whatever the law enforcement agency is, that if somebody resists arrest, there is absolutely no level of force that is unjustified.
And one of the things,
you know, one of the things that you turned me on to this past week was the John Oliver show.
Yes.
And I went back, watched this most recent episode where they talked about facial recognition. I went back 1 week before, a little disappointed in turning onto that episode, because that was the episode where he basically talked about the police.
Oh yeah. He really broke it down.
Nailed it, which was that we have basically not only militarized police, but we have trained them to view the general population as the opposition. We have trained them that we have an expectation of them to be comfortable killing people, that we have almost removed from the situation the likelihood of a de-escalation of the situation, that we have trained cops to mirror and escalate regardless of the situation. And then he wraps that whole story up with a nice, you know, in a nice bow by pointing out that we have put so many different social services that we used to fund have now fallen under the police umbrella in terms of what our expectations are of police. And we have not trained them on how to handle those situations.
Right.
So you've got a mentally ill person walking the streets, and who do you call when you see that? Well, you can't call a mental hospital. They don't exist anymore. You can't call a counselor because that's not what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to call the police. And what do the police do? Police show up and deal with criminals.
Right.
So they assume this mentally ill person is a criminal, and it is their job to ensure that that person is not a threat to greater society. But they don't know how to approach this person and speak to them in a manner which can somewhat lower the threat that this person poses.
Well, and one of the officers involved had been in a de-escalation seminar not 2 months ago.
Right.
So you can't even say it's training.
But it's not training. It's a couple of, how long of a seminar is it?
It was a 9-hour seminar.
So that's 2 days.
But regardless of the fact that he was trained just 2 months ago on how to de-escalate system, and it doesn't need to be two armed men going to deal with a guy sleep in a car. And as it turns out, apparently he was on probation. A DUI would have sent him back to jail. So he doesn't drive drunk. He goes to sleep in a parking lot. That was his only crime.
Well, and he was when he got in the car. He drove the car to Wendy's.
He drove the car to Wendy's, but he at least was like, all right, I shouldn't be doing this. Like there was a cognitive thought to be like, all right, I'm fucking up right now. But regardless, it shouldn't be a death sentence.
There's gotta be a way to approach that situation and provide alternatives that do not end up with this man getting shot.
Right. How tough would it be for someone, let's say it's a social worker, a medical professional, whatever, to have gone, made sure he was okay, and say, all right, why don't we get you an Uber home? You can come back and get your car tomorrow. And
How many times has that happened in white neighborhoods?
Yeah. Hell, cops used to drive white folks home when they were driving drunk. I remember that back in the 80s. You know,
they drove you home?
I mean, not me, but I'm just saying, I know of people. And this is where the whole concept of defunding the police comes in. It's that we are spending so much money on these huge police departments, militarizing them, but they're handling things that they don't need to handle. You know, if you've got a cat stuck in a tree, you call the police. If you've got a lost dog, if you've got, you know, whatever. There is a plethora of things that we call the police. Someone's drawing in chalk on a wall. Do the cops need to come for that? No.
No.
Cops need to handle, you know, major crimes. That's
crimes.
It.
Crimes, yes.
And so if you defund the police, you take away some of that money and you fund other areas that can, you know, like I said, whether it's social workers, whether it's mental health professionals, I guarantee you see... maybe not less crime, but I think you see people getting help. I think you see people not dying at the hands of the police. You know, I used to, and stop me if I've told this story, but back when I was working, there was a Philadelphia police officer who would come in and have lunch where I worked. And he and I would have conversations because I was always curious in his take because he was an African-American gentleman. And I always wanted to see, you know, when in seeing these things, and his thing was, well, it's always training. You know, this guy did this wrong, this guy did this wrong. And his big thing was, well, I'd rather be judged by 12 than carried by 6. And I get that. But if you're not in a life-threatening situation, I don't know that you need to think that way. But the one thing that he said to me one time is, I was like, what's the biggest challenge of being a cop right now? And he said, but the biggest challenge of being a cop is people don't like cops and people don't want to be cops. He's like, so I've been doing this for 12 years, and I see people in the police academy now that would have never passed the psych evaluation 12 years ago. And why is that? Because we have numbers we have to meet. We have federal guidelines we have to meet. We have to have a certain number of cops on the street. So he's like, forget racist cops. We just have bad cops.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, and I think Chris Rock made the joke one time, like, you know, police work is not a, you know, it's like a airline pilot. It's not a job where you can afford to have a bad airline pilot. You can't afford to have a bad police officer either. So if it's gotten to the point, and I'm sure Philadelphia is not alone in that situation. I'm sure in every major city, you have people becoming police officers every year that shouldn't be in the job. Whether whether they're racist, whether there's a mental condition, whether they're just not up for the job. So
whether they're trying to be police officers because they want to beat citizens.
Right. Because they're like, I get to bully people, I might get to beat people up, and God willing, I might get to shoot somebody.
Yes.
So if you are at that point where police are just putting anybody on the job because they have to have a certain number of bodies on the street, then defunding them makes even more sense because then you are shrinking the police departments down to the size where it is people who should actually be cops are out there. Right. And then you're putting all of these fringe tasks that the cops don't need to be doing. You're putting them into other areas. You're filling other jobs and you are hopefully providing better service for your citizens and keeping your citizens from being killed.
The other thing, and I think this was New York, was the police unions. They are such a strong, powerful block that in other professions, if you fuck up, you are held accountable for your actions.
Right.
But the police unions are probably the strongest union in this country, in the sense that if you have screwed up on your job, obviously the stakes are so much higher for a police officer. I don't think I could handle those stakes. You know, right. I don't think that I could knock on a door not knowing what's going on the inside of that door. You know, but it's the fact that there is absolutely a zero tolerance in terms of acceptance of wrongdoing by their members when the police union is confronted by any type of accusation of wrongdoing.
Well,
the police, they vehemently immediately, like take Atlanta, for instance. Mm-hmm. These two officers were charged.
One was charged for murder. The other was charged kind of as an accessory.
When you see me do this with my hands and I become silent, it's usually the cue for you to come in with some facts. But immediately, like the next shift after the announcement of these charges yesterday, the percentage of Atlanta police officers calling out sick.
What's that? It's that blue flu that they always talk about. We saw it in Buffalo when the officers were charged for breaking a guy's skull. 57 police officers resigned from their emergency squad.
It is this attitude of we can do no wrong. And if we do wrong, we will absolutely refuse to admit that we did wrong. And then, and this is something that that union chief in his speech, I think it was New York, they turn around and play the victim.
Yeah.
They try to control the dialogue so that they're the victims. You know, he was standing there screaming, "You have to stop treating us like animals, and we, you know, show us respect, and you know, this will all get." It's like, but do you understand that at some point you did wrong?
Yeah.
And your utter refusal to acknowledge you did wrong is one of the areas where this whole dialogue goes to shit, because it's hard to sit there and try to find common ground with someone that you're having a disagreement with when they're standing there saying, "I've done nothing wrong.
Yeah.
I'm guiltless here."
And what's interesting is in New York City, after the Eric Garner death, when again, you know, there was a chance that the officers were going to be charged, like the union basically was like, "Well, it'd be a shame if, you know, we had to pull back from our duties because we don't feel we can do our duties." And that's exactly what they did. They, for a period of about 7 or 8 months, they did what they call work to rule, which is only the most necessary duties. They didn't prosecute any low-level crimes, you know, narcotics, things of that nature.
But they got paid fully, correct?
They got paid fully, but what was interesting is when researchers went back and took a look at that, you know, yes, obviously minor crimes dropped because they weren't really being, you know, sought out. You know, they weren't, the police weren't mm-hmm. doing anything. But major crimes dropped anywhere from 3 to 6% during the same time.
Really?
So, you know, what the police forces in this country do, they work off of this concept called the broken window concept, whereas if you prosecute the most minor crimes in your city, so it's let's say someone breaks a window, you arrest them. If you prosecute the most minor crimes, then that will prevent the major crimes from happening. Because people see how tough you are in minor crimes. So someone's like, "Well, I'm not, if I can get arrested for breaking a window, I'm not going to rob a bank."
Okay.
But New York City showed the exact opposite. You know, each week during the slowdown in New York City, you know, civilians reported an estimated 53 fewer felony assaults, 40 fewer burglaries, and 40 fewer acts of grand larceny. And it was anywhere from 7 to 14 weeks after these drops in proactive policing. So these researchers that looked at all this information, and they looked at it over like a 4-year period. So they had, mm-hmm. you know, they had a kind of a bell curve to work off of. But they estimate that overall the slowdown resulted in about 2,100 fewer major crime complaints.
Really?
So again, there's another argument that you don't need all these police. is that yeah. our police creating a bigger problem than they're solving.
Yeah.
And I think we'll see in Atlanta also. Like, I don't think police understand at this point that in your typical major city, the threat of police not being around is not a threat mm-hmm. anymore. I think people would rather police themselves than worry about the police overseeing them and watching their fellow citizens get killed. And that's what we're seeing in Seattle right now. In the Chaz area.
Fucking shame. That is a fucking yeah. fucking shame.
But until the police unions and a lot of these police officers get that through their heads, that people would rather have no police than the police yeah. that they have right now, there's not going to be any productive change.
But it also, and I think at some point, you know, we could talk about this forever, but I think ultimately it is the fact of the motto of the police department has always been to protect and serve. Mm-hmm. And it boils down to who are you protecting and who are you serving? Because when the police department fails or loses their ability to protect and serve the community that they are tasked with protecting and serving, then they've lost legitimacy. Right. And I think that's what's happening here, is that people don't view the police as serving them. And I don't think that the police believe that they're serving the community.
Well, police are protecting themselves, and they're showing that. They showed it in New York City. They showed it in Buffalo. They showed it in Atlanta. They showed it in Minneapolis. They're more concerned with protecting each other. Listen, we've mm-hmm. all worked at jobs where we had shitty people working alongside us that we wished would get fired. And I don't know about you. Yes. I never covered anybody's ass. Like, if someone fucked up and needed to get fired, that was on them. But the police don't want to operate that way.
I've covered for people.
Have you? Well, I hope you're a better person moving forward.
I would like to think so, but I also am not a snitch.
All right. Well, snitches get stitches. I get it. Well, it was good to get back to a somewhat normal episode. We will yeah. be doing Patreon again after this. We always encourage you to sign up for as little as, like, what, $5 a month to have access yeah. to additional content. You can get some great Ron and Brian swag. So just go to ronandbrianpodcast.com. In the upper right corner, you'll see a little link there as to how to be a patron. Brian, anything additional this week?
The only thing that I would like to say, Ron, is that you're whack, you're twisted, your girl's a hoe, you're broke, your kid ain't yours, and everybody knows. Your old man say you're stupid, you'd be like, so? I love my baby mama. I'll never let her go.
I don't have too much more to say after that. Thank you for joining us, everybody. Catch you all next week. But if you're a Patreon subscriber, catch us on the Patreon.